pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day when one of our greatest and most influential Republican conservative political voices has just given a very important piece of advice to President Trump, the presumed nominee of the Republican Party for another term as president. He says that if Trump wants to alienate women for some reason, he can do so automatically by making a particular vice presidential pick. Which one would particularly alienate women? A constituency which represents, by the way, the majority of all voters. We will find out when we speak to Rich Lowry, the editor of National Review, coming up on the Michael Medved Show. Meanwhile, another leading and prominent conservative voice, the great former senator from the state of Nebraska, Ben Sasse, had a great deal to say over the weekend. He was speaking with Jake Tapper on CNN about his leadership of the University of Florida, which seems to have avoided the kind of giving in and the so-called negotiations with demonstrators that other campuses have done. I mean, the University of Washington, I was away this weekend with my wife at an extraordinary event. I've never seen anything like it or experienced anything like it. Heard about it before, but being there was something amazing. We had gone out to the shareholders meeting for Berkshire Hathaway, otherwise known as the Warren Buffett show. It was amazing. I'll tell you a little bit more about it. But one of the things that's strange is coming home to Seattle last night and having been at a place where capitalism and business and American ingenuity and the American tradition is so lovingly celebrated with people from around the world. We'll play you some of the highlights and lowlights of this event. But more than 20,000 people jammed into this arena and just ecstatic and happy and positive. And it's the opposite of what's going on at universities in this country. They even have some demonstration at the University of Nebraska. That's a different story. When coming home, found out that the latest was the University of Washington was negotiating with the demonstrators, the pro-Hamas demonstrators. And what is it that the pro-Hamas demonstrators wanted the University of Washington to do? To divest, not from Israel, that goes without saying, but from Boeing. Now, Boeing, of course, has been a great beneficiary of the University of Washington and multiple charitable endeavors here in the Seattle area. It used to be the one big dominant company in this area. And the fact that the university turned them down, said, no, we have a historic relationship with Boeing. They've supported the University of Washington and the Huskies for more than 100 years. And that's literally true. And no, they are not going to sever all ties with Boeing. But now there are people on hunger strikes and demanding that you cut off connection with Boeing. None of that is going on at the University of Florida. And Ben Sasse was on with Jake Tapper talking about the difference between his campus, where he left the U.S. Senate to become president of that fine university, and he affirmed some of the common sense principles that have become his calling card. This is clip number one. Listen.
It's interesting because notably after Governor DeSantis ordered campuses at Florida to deactivate a more radical pro-Palestinian group called Students for Justice in Palestine, you opted to not do so because of free speech concerns. Where does a university president draw a line between free speech concerns with the right of every student on campus to feel safe and secure and also, frankly, to enjoy college and graduation?
Here, here. Great question. I think the line is between speech and action. I'm a First Amendment zealot, and it's a glorious thing that our First Amendment gives us free speech, freedom of religion, press, assembly, protest, or redress of grievances. There are five glorious freedoms in the First Amendment. And what we tell all of our students, protesters and non, is there are two things we're going to affirm over and over again. We will always defend your right to free speech and free assembly. And also, we have time, place, and manner restrictions. And you don't get to take over the whole university. People don't get to spit at cops. You don't get to barricade yourselves in buildings. You don't get to disrupt somebody else's commencement. We don't allow protest inside. On my run this morning after I left the Swamp, which is our football stadium, I got to run the stadium this morning. I ran by our group of protesters waving their Palestinian flag. We protect their right to do that. But we have rules. And one of those rules is we don't allow camping on campus. And so you can't start to build an encampment. But our goal is not to arrest people. It's to help them get into compliance with the rules.
Okay. And that, of course, is profound and important. He also has a piece in the Wall Street Journal, which appeared over the weekend. And he writes in the journal, Ben Sasse, higher education has for years faced a slow-burning crisis of public trust. Mob rule at some of America's most prestigious universities in recent weeks has thrown gasoline on the fire. Pro-Hamas agitators have fought police, barricaded themselves in university buildings, shut down classes, forced commencement cancellations, and physically impeded Jewish students from attending lectures. Parents are rightly furious at the asinine entitlement of these activists and the embarrassing timidity of many college administrations. One parent put it bluntly, why the hell should anybody spend their money to send their kid to college? Employers watching this fiasco are asking the same question. And then he writes, at the University of Florida, we tell parents and future employers, we're not perfect, but the adults are still in charge. Our response to threats to build encampments is driven by three basic truths. First, universities must distinguish between speech and action, which he already said. Second, universities must say what they mean and then do what they say. Empty threats make everything worse. Any parent who has endured a two-year-old's tantrum gets this. You can't say, don't make me come up there if you aren't willing to walk up the stairs and enforce the rules. You don't make a threat until you've decided to follow through if necessary. In the same way, universities make things worse with half-hearted appeals to abide by existing policies and then immediately negotiating with 20-year-old toddlers. A third, universities need to recommit themselves to real education rather than engage a wide range of ideas with curiosity and intellectual humility. Many academic disciplines have capitulated to a dogmatic view of identity politics. Students are taught to divide the world into immutable categories of oppressors and oppressed and to make sweeping judgments accordingly, with little regard for historical complexity. All of this is enormously important. And it's enormously important to take note of the alternative. The protesters at the University of Michigan graduation, this is remarkable. The protesters not all screamed at Governor Whitmer at her daughter's graduation celebration. What did they scream? We will get to that. We'll also be speaking with Rich Lowry about the vice presidential sweepstakes coming up on the Medved Show.
Michael Medved. We'll be right back.
And one of the stars of the Democratic Party, at least at the moment, is Governor Whitmer, Gretchen Whitmer, of the state of Michigan. She just got reelected by a very robust majority. And she was attending her daughter's graduation ceremony when she was, and by the way, I do think Governor Whitmer is almost surely going to be a presidential candidate in 2028. Now, why do I say that? Because Joe Biden can't run for reelection, even if he is reelected this time. He will be way too old to try to pull a Trump or a Grover Cleveland. And after losing this election to Trump, if Trump is elected, Gretchen Whitmer will be one of the leading contenders for president, and so will Gavin Newsom of California for the Democratic Party, which you can look at those two and say, boy, the Democratic Party is in sad shape. But you can look at what's happening on campus when she just was attending her daughter's graduation celebration. What's happened there shows that it's actually America that's in sad shape right now with the brain-dead demonstrators running wild. Listen.
Genocide! How do you justify genocide? How do you justify genocide? How do you sleep at night?
Genocide. How do you justify?
What are you doing about Palestinian children? What are you doing about Palestinian students
genocide?
At the U of M?
I appreciate you raising your voice. I'm here to have a graduation meal with my daughter.
How do you
what about all of the children that are in mass graves? What about them?
Genocide.
Yeah, are you doing anything about it?
Okay, what is it they expect the governor of Michigan to do about it? And what is so extraordinary here is... And again, it seems to me it's one of those things that I was thinking about over the weekend, particularly, is the pro-Hamas demonstrators, like what you just heard, people all over the country waving Palestinian flags. I completely understand and sympathize with people who wave Ukrainian flags, because what the Ukrainians are engaged in is honorable. It's a defense of their country. They did not start a war. The Palestinians, people who honor the Palestinian flag, the terrorist group Hamas, which had controlled Gaza with no interference, with no presence of any Israeli personnel or law enforcement or military or anything like that, the Hamas had controlled Gaza Strip from 2007. The Israelis evacuated in 2005. Hamas took over in 2007 and basically ran the place into the ground. And then, of course, committed the hideous atrocities, indescribable atrocities, of October 7th. What are you proud of in identifying yourself with the cause of Palestinian terrorists? What are their great accomplishments? Murdering 11 Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics in the 1970s? Committing the Intifada, the second Intifada, where a couple of thousand Israelis died through suicide bombings? Raising whole generations who are so filled with hatred that they're willing to blow themselves into little bloody chunks of flesh just for the sake of murdering Jewish people. It's a crazy situation. And the identification with the Palestinian cause is based on what principles that cause is advancing. Any principles of democracy, of tolerance, of brotherhood or sisterhood, of personal liberty, anywhere reflected in the code of Islamists like Hamas, and not just Islamists, but Islamist terrorists. Sarah Jacobs, a Democrat from California's 51st district, was on MSNBC and suggesting that being anti-Zionist, supporting the positions of Hamas, is not in any way anti-Semitic. Really? Listen, this is clip 8.
So Zionism is the idea that the Jewish people should have a homeland. And it's premised on the ideology that nation states are based on peoples and nations having statehood. And the idea that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitic is really premised on the idea that the Jewish people are the only people for whom this idea is questioned. And I understand, I do understand people who feel that way. But, you know, I work in international conflict resolution all over the world, and I can tell you that it's simply not the case. You know, just in the Middle East, you have the Kurds. In Europe, you have Basque Country, you have Catalan. I'm the ranking member of the Africa subcommittee. There are many places in Africa, like Somaliland, like the Igbo people, the Republic of Biafra in Nigeria, who, you know, whether or not they should get a state is contested. And so to me, the idea that it's only the Jewish people who are having this concept questioned for is just not actually accurate with what we see in the world. And that's why I don't believe it's inherently an anti-Semitic thing to question.
Okay, it is completely accurate because those other people she has mentioned, by the way, Israel has long been, Israel has a substantial Kurdish community. My late father, when he would be coming back from his hospital treatments in Jerusalem, would stop at a Kurdish restaurant, a Kurdish kosher restaurant. And there's great sympathy for the Kurdish people who, with God's help, will someday have their own state that they will build. But the point is, Israel wasn't given a state. And this is one of those things that shows a profound ignorance of history by congressmen, by the congressman who made Sarah Jacobs, who made this claim. Because Israel, it wasn't that people were looking over the world and saying, oh, a lot of displaced Jews, we need to give them a state. It was the Jewish people ourselves rising up, particularly in the 1880s and then with Herzl in the 1890s, who actually went to the Middle East, where Palestine at the time, which was a Turkish province, was severely underpopulated and could deal with more people. But it's not a question of enabling another people to form a state. It's a question of taking a state that's already been formed, functioning as an independent nation for 75 years, and questioning its very right to exist. That is uniquely anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. We'll be right back. And on the Michael Medved Show, this is, again, one of those situations that we run into, the question about, is there such a thing as anti-Zionism without anti-Semitism? And when you talk about Zionism being a movement of national pride and of national reconstruction for the Jewish people, the question would be, is there any other form of nationalism where, if it is peaceful and constructive and does not believe in seizing the property of others, that would be held to be somehow racist and unacceptable? And this is one of those elements that makes it so surprising that we have people in universities across the country right now who are flying Palestinian flags, which, by the way, have never, ever flown over any country in the history of the world. They fly right now over the country of Jordan because the Palestinian flag is the same as the Jordanian flag. And in fact, one third of the population of Jordan is Palestinian, including the Queen of Jordan, who is married to King Abdullah II, who's visiting the United States. But Queen Rania is proudly Palestinian in Jordan. In any event, John Fetterman, senator from Pennsylvania, who has been so unexpectedly great, despite the fact that he's a Democrat. Certainly there are many Democrats who are very supportive of the state of Israel. And one of them is John Fetterman of Pennsylvania, who was on CBS with Margaret Brennan and sounded like this.
Agree with the ACLU saying that it's wrong to equate criticism of the Israeli government with anti-Semitism?
No, I'm not really sure what's really the I don't agree. I mean, I do think a lot of the criticism right now during this the Gaza war, I think it, at its root, does have some anti-Semitism there as well, too. Now, it's, you know, you don't have to agree with the Israeli government, but a lot of the protesting and a lot of the words that are being thrown around on a lot of these campuses, you know, are actually very anti-Semitism.
How is it not anti-Semitic to say from the river to the sea, all of Palestine will be free? Because from the river to the sea, there are 8 million Jews who live in that space. And they built that country. And again, this goes back to that same thing that Congresswoman Jacobs was misleading people about. And it's so important to get the truth correct and right, which is that when Israel declared its independence following UN recognition with a vote on partition and the creation, establishment, recognition of a Jewish state, there were already 600,000 Jews who had built a country and where a majority of the people in the land that would be designated for the new Jewish state were Jewish. Meanwhile, there was an appearance that has attracted a great deal of attention from Tim Scott, because Tim Scott, generally the vice presidential sweepstakes, which we're going to be talking about with Rich Lowry of National Review in a few moments, has focused a lot on four people. Tim Scott and South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, and very much on Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, and also Doug Burgum, the governor of North Dakota. But Tim Scott, who is probably the leading contender for the vice presidential nomination for the Republicans, was on with Kristen Welker on Meet the Press. And she asked him a question six times, which he refused to answer. Listen, clip two.
Will you commit to accepting the election results of 2024? Bottom line.
At the end of the day, the 47th president of the United States will be President Donald Trump. And I'm excited to give back to low inflation, low unemployment.
Wait, Senator, yes or no? Yes or no? Will you accept the election results of 2024 no matter who wins?
That is my statement.
But is it just yes or no? Will you accept the election results of 2024?
I look forward to President Trump being the 47th president. Kristen, you can ask him multiple times.
Senator, just a yes or no answer.
So the American people, the American people will make the decision.
But I don't hear you committing
for President Trump. That's clear.
I don't hear you committing to the election results.
Here's the deal.
Will you commit to accepting the election results?
This is why so many Americans believe that NBC is an extension of the Democrat Party. At the end of the day, I've said what I've said, and I know that the American people, their voices will be heard, and I believe that President Trump will be our next president. It's that simple.
But, Senator, as you know, the hallmark of our democracy is that both candidates agree to a peaceful transfer of power. So I'm asking you, as a potential VP nominee, will you accept to commit to the election results in this election cycle, no matter who wins? Just simply yes or no.
I expect President Trump to win the next election.
Okay, this is pathetic, frankly. She asked him six times, and he won't say. Now, what he could have said if he wanted to protect himself and to protect Trump's insistence that the last election was stolen, is say, I as long as the election results are not contested, that they are not suspect, they do not involve some evidence of fraud or cheating of any kind, and I expect that they won't, then of course I expect to accept the election results and look forward to a vigorous contest, something like that. But this refusal to even say, okay, the results of the election, I will accept. That probably didn't help that interchange, Tim Scott. Then there was Kristi Noem, who had a tough time over the weekend, too. She went on CBS Mornings and said that she won't say definitively whether or not she actually met with Kim Jong-un. And this is something that she had talked about in her book, which is having all kinds of problems. This is clip five.
When you write in the book, I remember when I met with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. I'm sure he underestimated me. That, as I understand, is now being removed from the book at your request.
Yes, when correct? I became aware of that, we changed the content, and the future editions will be adjusted. And, I appreciate that. I've met with many, many world leaders. I've traveled around the world. I should not have put that anecdote in the book. And at my request, they have
that removed it. That specific meeting didn't happen?
I'm saying that I'm not talking about that meeting. I'm not talking about my meetings with world leaders.
But you there's do some talk that are about in meetings the book. With world leaders.
There's some that are in the book, and then there's some that not in the book. Many
but why
of them
are there
actually,
two specific mentions of meeting Kim Jong-un and talking about him and a specific memory? I'm sure he underestimated me, having no clue about my experience staring down little tyrants. Did you tell your ghostwriter to write that?
I've specifically have worked on policy for over 30 years. And over that time, I have traveled around the world and I have met with leaders around the world. And that anecdote, I've asked them to change the content and it will be removed.
It's a simple question. Did you or did you not
meet with Kim Jong-un? That's the answer that I have for you, is that it will be adjusted. And as soon as I became aware of it, that content was removed.
Okay, why can't she say it was a mistake? And why can't she acknowledge that, okay, when I had the mistake in the book, a fanciful meeting that didn't occur, we corrected it. It's a tough series of questions. So what about the choice for vice president? We'll be talking about that with Rich Lowry, coming right up on The Medved Show.
More of Michael Medved in a moment.
Always a pleasure to welcome back to the show Rich Lowry, the editor of National Review, who also writes for Politico. He is the author of the outstanding book, The Case for Nationalism, and Lincoln Unbound. And he's recently written about a stroke of genius that is eligible for President Trump if he wants to alienate women everywhere with his vice presidential pick. What is the one pick that President Trump could make, Rich Lowry, in your opinion, could alienate the female voters?
He could go with Kristi Noem, who is one of the least sympathetic politicians in America at the moment.
chose to go out of her way to tell the story of killing a dog in her book. Dog killing is one of the most unpopular acts in America. Unfortunately, it's more unpopular than abortion in America at the moment. Apparently, Trump and his people around him were stunned by the inclusion of this anecdote. And then there's a fake anecdote. Dog thing is very real, but a fake anecdote about meeting Kim Jong-un, and she was dragged over the coals for this on a Sunday show appearance yesterday, and just as clearly not ready for prime time, which I guess is fine because she's not going to be in prime time.
Okay, well, first of all, this meeting with Kim Jong-un, how does she did not go forward and say, yes, I really did meet with him, because she apparently didn't. How do you forget something like that? I mean, yeah, obviously...
How many people in the West have met Kim Jong-un, right? It's like Trump and Mike Pompeo and a couple other people. So, yeah, it's not the kind of thing you forget. And she read the audio version of this book prior to its release. I don't think it's been technically been published yet. So she knew this was in there, unless she totally blanked while she was reading it as well. So this is just campaign memoirs or political books are supposed to help you, and this has done the opposite.
Well, again, the book is called No Going Back, and now she's going back and correcting part of it. Okay, what about her suggestion that President Biden should kill his dog?
Yeah, so I think it was bad that those dogs were left at the White House for so long to terrorize Secret Service agents. I'm not an expert on dogs, but those dogs seem to be a little bit head cases and probably should be out in the country somewhere running free, rather than a stressful environment with a bunch of people around. I don't know whether you'd necessarily want to put them down, but they shouldn't have been left there that long.
There's also something, I think her suggestion was that President Biden should not only kill his dog, but shoot his dog, as she did with Cricket, her 14-month-old dog that had a real adjustment problem with attacking people and et cetera. Kristi Noem, you don't think is going to be the choice for President Trump. That leaves Tim Scott, who we were also talking with listeners, did not have an exactly stellar appearance on Meet the Press.
Yeah, I just don't think I like Tim Scott. I just don't think he's that deft, and I think it's going to be hard for him to thrive at this level if he's selected by Trump, because it's a real cauldron, both in terms of the outside game and the press coming at you constantly, and also the inside game kind of tiptoeing around and maintaining the relationship with President Trump. So I'd be skeptical that he's up for it. It wasn't a disaster, but it wasn't the greatest appearance. He got kind of cornered on whether he'll get the results of 2024, where I think the answer would be, yeah, that's my intention, unless I see real indications of terrible fraud, which I hope we don't see. And I kind of leave it at that. But he refused to answer the question as it was put to him about six times.
Yeah. Okay. So who does that leave, and where do you think President Trump is most likely to turn?
I should preface this with I do not have inside knowledge, but my understanding is they really like Doug Burgum. He goes down real easy. He's easy to work with. He was an early endorsee after he dropped out of the presidential race himself, and I think now is probably the top safe choice. It's not going to help him politically, but he can start working donors early on, seems pretty sure-footed, is unlikely to be a catastrophe. And there's something to be said for that in a VP pick. I think Marco Rubio, but for the problem of Florida, that they're both from Florida, Trump and Rubio, would be a pick that could help you politically. Having someone who speaks Spanish campaigning for you all around the country when Latinos seem to be swinging your way would be a major advantage. He's become more a MAGA-type populist than he was when he ran himself in 2016. And then I wouldn't sleep on J.D. Vance, who now is totally aligned ideologically with Trump and a complete personal loyalist, and a lot of MAGA people would welcome as an ideological heir to Trump.
Couldn't they bring up a lot of clips from the past with J.D. Vance saying terrible things about President Trump?
They could, and they would. J.D.'s gotten a fair amount of this already. There'd be a lot more of it. And I think the question there is just how much does Trump sort of take J.D.'s sincerity of his conversion does he trust him? And can Trump himself kind of abide seeing all that stuff again? I think those are the key questions there.
And in terms of Burgum, he also has a financial advantage. He got $1 billion for selling his company. He could actually bring some money into the campaign, yep, which the campaign cares about, no?
Yep, the campaign cares about it and needs it. So that's another plus to Burgum.
What about the idea, and again, I think we're seeing this right now in excelsis. I don't even know what the latest was from the testimony today and the uplifting hush money trial, yeah, everyone's favorite subject. But while Trump is tied up in courtrooms, and that's going to be several weeks going forward, wouldn't it be useful to actually have a designated running mate who could go out there and sort of run interference, talk about issues, campaign personally,
yep,
while Trump is otherwise engaged?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a lot to be said for that. I have a friend who's been making the case for a while. Not only should he pick a VP early, he should pick a cabinet officer, top cabinet officials early for the same reason, because you can have these people doing fundraising out there as surrogates while you're tied down in a courtroom 8 hours a day.
And what about Mike Pompeo? Again, I was actually at the stockholders convention for Berkshire Hathaway in Omaha over the weekend, and there are a lot of people saying, "Whatever happened to Mike Pompeo? He was a good Secretary of State. Is he on anyone's list for a cabinet post this time, or the vice presidency?
I don't think he's on the VP list. For me, he'd be another good safe choice, kind of a Cheney-esque governing choice. But the rumor, and again, I do not have direct knowledge of this, is that he's interested in defense. I think he'd be, if he got defense, he'd be the first one to serve as CIA director, Secretary of State, and Secretary of Defense. Those are all three pretty major and consequential positions. You know, he had a little distance from Trump after the 2020 election, but apparently that's been healed. So it wouldn't surprise me if that's something that happens.
I think Mike Pompeo does not believe the election was stolen, or at least he hasn't affirmed that the election has been stolen.
Correct. He hasn't. And look, this goes to key awkwardness for a lot of these guys. Burgum got some tough questions about this on CNN. We're talking about over the weekend. We're talking about Tim Scott. As a lot of these guys are kind of regular Republicans, and said, you know what, it's not stolen. It's terrible what happened on January 6th. And the party's orthodoxy is just in a very different place. And obviously, the presidential candidate's orthodoxy is in a very different place. So for anyone who wasn't on board Trump's kind of take on these things from the beginning, there's going to be major awkwardness around that stuff.
And do you think it's a fantasy when Democrats raise the possibility of replacing Kamala Harris on the ticket? There's no chance that Biden would attempt to orchestrate that.
Can't see it. You know, he's got a tough enough road to hoe as it is, and potential disruption and discord around his VP pick, you know, first African-American vice president, wouldn't help. So I think just caution is going to counsel. Let it go, grit your teeth, grin and bear it, and hope it works out.
Okay, hush money trial, guilty or not guilty, and would it hurt Trump if he is found guilty?
I think guilty, probably a 70% chance guilty, maybe a 30% chance that there's a hung jury or some legal ruling in his favor, but that doesn't seem very likely with this judge. I'm not sure it would stand up ultimately. I think it's a terrible case, and he'd eventually win on appeal. And then I think, you know, it shocks the system for about 2 weeks, and a lot of other things, like a lot of other things, it's absorbed into the background, and I think that would especially be the case given the inconsequential subject matter here.
Rich Lowry, his most recent commentaries, which are amusing and insightful as always, posted at michaelmedved.com in This Greatest Nation.